The ballroom of Whitmore House had seen better years. The chandeliers still glittered. The champagne still flowed. The guests still laughed with their mouths open and their eyes calculating, the way people do when they are performing wealth rather than possessing it. But anyone who had stood in this room 20 years ago, when old Lord Whitmore was alive and the estate hummed with genuine prosperity, would have noticed the small signs of slow ruin. The drapes a shade too faded. The flower arrangements slightly past their peak. The silver on the buffet table, just a few pieces fewer than there used to be. No one noticed these things, of course. They were too busy noticing the Duke. Edmund Ashford, the 8th Duke of Ashford, had arrived at 9:30, which was either fashionably late or deliberately strategic depending on who you asked. He was tall in the way that men with real authority tend to be, not because of his height exactly, but because of the way he occupied space, as though the room had quietly rearranged itself around him without being asked. He spoke little. He smiled less. And when his dark eyes moved across a room, people had the unsettling feeling of being read rather than seen. He was here for business, land contracts, a dispute over the eastern parcels of the Whitmore estate that had been dragging through solicitors' offices for the better part of 2 years. Victor Whitmore had finally agreed to a meeting, and Edmund had agreed to make it social. He did not particularly enjoy social. He was standing near the fireplace, holding a glass of wine he had not touched, when Victor Whitmore appeared at his elbow, flushed, jovial, the particular brand of nervous that tries very hard to look like confidence. And behind Victor, carrying a tray of fresh glasses with the quiet efficiency of someone who had learned to move through a room without being looked at, was a young woman. Edmund looked at her the way he looked at everything, briefly, completely, and without expression. Then Victor opened his mouth. "Ah, you'll need a fresh glass, Your Grace." Here, he snapped his fingers without turning around. "Girl, come." The young woman stepped forward. She set the tray down on the side table with practiced steadiness. She did not look up. "Our housemaid," Victor said, already turning away, already gesturing toward the next guest he wanted Edmund to meet. "Quite reliable. Now, Your Grace, I wanted to introduce you to Lord Penville." Edmund did not move. He was looking at the housemaid's hands. They were still, perfectly, deliberately still, the hands of someone who had decided long ago that stillness was a form of protection. But they were not a servant's hands, no roughness across the knuckles, no evidence of hours spent scrubbing and carrying and wringing. And her posture, even now, even with her eyes lowered and her shoulders carefully drawn in, was not the posture of someone who had grown up serving. It was the posture of someone who had grown up being told to sit straight at a dinner table. She lifted her eyes for exactly 1 second. Not to Victor, not to the room. To Edmund. It lasted no longer than a heartbeat. And in that heartbeat, Edmund Ashford saw something he had not expected to find in a Whitmore ballroom on a Tuesday evening in November. He saw a person who was lying, and who was very, very good at it. He said nothing. He accepted the fresh glass. He allowed Victor to steer him toward Lord Penville. But for the rest of the evening, without appearing to do so, he watched her. Her name was Cecily Whitmore, though no one in that ballroom used it. She had learned in the 2 years since her stepfather's death had left her in Victor's custody that names were a kind of currency, and like all currency, they could be taken away. Victor had taken hers gradually, first in small ways, the way a tide removes sand, one wave at a time. She was no longer introduced at dinners, no longer seated with the family when guests arrived, no longer consulted about anything, not the household accounts, not the menus, not the calendar of social engagements that had once been managed by her mother, and then, briefly, by her. By the time Victor began referring to her as asterisk the girl to the staff, most of the staff had already started doing it themselves. It was simply easier. and Cecily had discovered that easier for other people often came at her expense. She had not planned to be in the ballroom that evening. Victor had summoned her an hour before the guests arrived, in the way he always summoned her, not with a knock, but with a message delivered through Mrs. Greer, the housekeeper, who had the decency to look uncomfortable when she delivered it. "Mr. Whitmore requires your assistance this evening. The housemaids are short-staffed. You are to help serve. A pause. He says you are to wear the gray dress." The gray dress. Not her own gray dress. She no longer had access to her wardrobe, which Victor had relocated to a storage room on the third floor 18 months ago on the grounds that she had asterisked more than she needed. The gray dress in question belonged to the household uniform stock. It fit poorly across the shoulders and was too short at the hem. She had put it on without comment. There was, she had learned, a particular kind of dignity available to people in her position, not the loud dignity of protest, which accomplished nothing and cost everything, but the quiet dignity of refusal to be diminished internally, no matter what was happening externally. She could wear the gray dress and still know exactly what she was. She could carry a tray and still understand compound interest, Italian correspondence, and the legal principles governing property held in trust. Victor knew she knew these things. That was, in fact, precisely why she was wearing the gray dress. The Duke had arrived later than expected. Cecily had been aware of his arrival before she saw him. The shift in the room's energy was unmistakable. Conversations paused. Spines straightened. Even Victor, who had been working the room with the manic sociability of a man who owed several people money, went momentarily still and then rearranged his face into something that was trying to be welcoming. She had not looked up when Edmund Ashford entered. She had not needed to. She had heard enough about him from the fragments of conversation that passed through rooms she was not supposed to be listening in on. The Duke of Ashford, serious man. Brilliant, some say, though not the warm kind of brilliant. Has a memory like a trap. He doesn't forget a number or a face. Victor, she recalled, had said this last part with a particular tightness around his jaw that she had filed away carefully. He doesn't forget a face. She had thought about that when Victor pulled her forward to hand over the glass. She had kept her eyes down. She had been very careful. And then she had made the mistake of looking up. Just for a moment. Just because something in the quality of the silence made her do it. Some animal instinct that said this is different, pay attention. And she had found the Duke of Ashford looking directly at her with an expression that was not quite curiosity and not quite recognition, and was, somehow, far more alarming than either. She had looked away immediately. She had spent the rest of the evening on the opposite side of the room. It was nearly midnight when the incident with the correspondence happened. One of the junior footmen, a boy of about 17 who was clearly overwhelmed by the scale of the evening, came to her in a panic near the service corridor. A letter had been delivered for the Duke, marked urgent, and no one could find Mr. Whitmore to authorize its delivery, and he didn't know what to do, and would she? "Give it to me," she said quietly. She took the letter to the small anteroom off the main hall where guests' coats had been stored, intending to leave it on the table with a note for Victor to handle. She was setting it down when she heard the door open behind her. She turned. The Duke of Ashford stood in the doorway. He looked at her, then at the letter in her hands, then at her again. "That's mine," he said. "Yes, Your Grace," she held it out. "It arrived this evening. I was ensuring it reached you." He crossed the room and took it. He did not open it. He was looking at her with that same quality of attention that she had noticed earlier, not rude, not warm, simply extremely thorough. "What is your name?" he said. The question was simple. The answer was complicated. She could feel the weight of every strategic calculation she had made over the past 2 years pressing down on the next 4 seconds. "Cecily," she said. Just Cecily, no last name, no asterisk Miss Whitmore, no claim. Something moved across his expression, too quickly to name. Cecily, he repeated, as though he were placing the word somewhere specific in his memory. Thank you. He left. She stood in the anteroom for a long moment after the door closed, the gray dress slightly too short at the hem, the sounds of the ball filtering through the wall, and something cold and careful settling in her chest. He had a memory like a trap. And she had just given him something to remember. Edmund Ashford had not intended to stay at Whitmore House. The original arrangement had been straightforward: attend the ball, make the necessary social appearances, spend 2 days reviewing the land contracts with Victor's solicitor, and return to London by Thursday. He had a full schedule waiting, a parliamentary matter that required his attention, 3 investment proposals that needed careful reading, and a dinner obligation he had been postponing for 6 weeks with a cousin who would eventually stop being patient about it. He sent a note to London on Wednesday morning, rescheduling everything by 1 week. He told himself it was because of the contracts. The Eastern parcel discrepancies were more substantial than his own solicitor had indicated, and he wanted to review the original survey documents personally rather than rely on copies. This was true. It was also, he was privately aware, not the complete truth. The complete truth was that he had slept very little on Tuesday night, which was unusual for him, and that when he had lain awake in the rather overdone guest bedroom on the second floor of Whitmore House, the thing occupying his mind was not acreage or property lines. It was a pair of still hands and a woman who had answered a direct question with half an answer, and done it so cleanly that he had almost missed it. Cecily, just Cecily. He had been lied to by ministers and deceived by men with far more practice at it, but there was a particular quality to this particular evasion that he found he could not set aside. It was not the lie of someone concealing guilt. It was the lie of someone concealing themselves, carefully, deliberately, out of some necessity he did not yet understand. Edmund Ashford did not like things he did not understand. Victor Whitmore was delighted by the Duke's extended stay. He showed it in the way insecure men show delight, too much, too loudly, tripping over himself to accommodate and impress. The best breakfast dishes appeared. 2 additional footmen were positioned near the dining room. Victor laughed at things that were not jokes and agreed with statements he had clearly not listened to. Edmund found him exhausting. He also found him useful in the way that transparent people are always useful, because a man who is trying too hard to appear confident is a man who is afraid of something, and afraid men make mistakes. On Wednesday afternoon, Edmund made his first request. He mentioned, to Victor over the contracts, that he had received a letter the previous evening requiring a response, correspondence from a business associate in Florence, which needed to be answered in Italian, as the man's English was unreliable. His own secretary had remained in London. Would it be possible to have someone assist with the translation? Victor's face went through several expressions in rapid succession. Of course, Mrs. Greer will know if any of the staff. He was already reaching for the bell pull. No urgency, Edmund said. Whoever is available. Mrs. Greer, when consulted, went very slightly still in a way that Edmund noted. Then she said she would make arrangements. 40 minutes later, there was a quiet knock at the library door. Cecily came in the way she did everything in this house, without taking up more space than was strictly necessary, without looking directly at him until she had assessed the room and its exits and apparently decided on her approach. She was wearing the gray dress again, or perhaps a different gray dress. It was difficult to tell. Mrs. Greer said you required assistance with a translation, Your Grace. I do. He gestured to the chair across the writing desk. Please sit. A very small pause. servants did not sit at the writing desk. She sat. He placed the letter in front of her. It was genuine. He had not manufactured the errand. His Florentine associate did write exclusively in Italian and did need a reply. But he watched her face as she read it, because a person's face when they read is one of the more honest things about them. She read quickly. Her lips didn't move. Her eyes tracked the lines with the easy fluency of someone who was not translating so much as simply reading in a second language. When she finished, she looked up. "He's asking about the silk tariffs," she said. "He's concerned about the new parliamentary proposals and whether they'll affect the northern routes. He wants to know your position before he commits to the spring contracts." Edmund looked at her steadily. "And what would you recommend I tell him?" Another pause, longer this time. "I beg your pardon. You've read the letter, you understand the context. What would you tell him?" She was quiet for a moment in the way that people are quiet when they are deciding something. Then something shifted very slightly in her expression, not softness exactly, but a kind of careful assessment, as though she were measuring him for something she hadn't expected to need a measurement for. "I would tell him," she said slowly, "that the parliamentary proposals are unlikely to pass in their current form, and that committing to the spring contracts carries manageable risk. But I would also tell him that if he is uncertain, he should wait, because a cautious man who waits rarely loses as much as an impatient one who doesn't." The room was very quiet. "That is," she added, dropping her eyes, "asterisk, if it were my correspondence." "It's good advice," Edmund said. "Write it." She came back the next morning for a second errand, a set of household inventory records that Victor's solicitor claimed supported the property survey, which Edmund found unconvincing, and which he wanted cross-referenced against the original estate ledgers. The ledgers were in the library. He needed someone who could read old accounting notation. Cecily could read old accounting notation. She didn't mention this. She simply sat down with the ledgers and the inventory records and began cross-referencing them with the methodical efficiency of someone who had spent a great deal of time alone with documents and found them, if not pleasant, at least reliable. Edmund worked at his own end of the table. He did not make conversation. Neither did she. At one point, without looking up from the ledger, she said, "Asterisk this entry, 1809, the boundary notation on the eastern parcel." He looked up. "It's been altered," she said. "The original figure is still visible if you hold it to the light. Someone changed the acreage." She said it the way she said everything, quietly, without drama, as though she were reporting a fact about the weather. Edmund set down his pen. "Show me," he said. She held the ledger up to the window light. He came around the table and stood beside her and looked. And there it was, the ghost of the original number beneath the new one, faint but unmistakable. He stood very still for a moment. Then he said, without inflection, "How long have you known that was there?" "A beat. I noticed it approximately 18 months ago," she said. "Your Grace." He looked at her profile. She was still looking at the ledger, her expression composed, her hand still. "Cecily," he said. She turned. "Who are you?" She held his gaze for a long moment, long enough that he thought, for once, she was going to answer him completely. Then the door opened, and Victor appeared in the doorway. And whatever had been about to happen closed off in her expression like a window being shuttered. "Your Grace, ah, good. I see the girl found you. I hope she's been useful." "Very," Edmund said. He did not look away from Cecily immediately. "Thank you," he told her. "That will be all for today." She rose. She set the ledger on the table. She moved past Victor in the doorway without looking at him. Victor watched her go, and then turned back to Edmund with a smile that was working harder than it should have needed to. "Reliable girl," he said again, "as I said." Yes, Edmund agreed. He looked down at the ledger, still open on the table. You did say that. There was a room on the third floor of Whitmore House that no one used anymore. It had been her father's study, not the formal one on the ground floor where he had received solicitors and tenants and men with documents requiring signatures, but the private one, the small one, the one with the good eastern light that he had claimed for himself on the grounds that he liked to watch the sun come up over the grounds while he had his first cup of coffee. He had kept his personal correspondence there, his books, a small portrait of Cecily's mother that he had commissioned the year before she died, and that had never been moved because he could not bear to. Victor had locked the room 14 months ago. He had not offered a reason. He had simply appeared one morning with a key and a locksmith, and by afternoon the room was sealed, and when Cecily had asked Mrs. Greer about it, Mrs. Greer had looked at the floor and said she didn't know anything about it, which meant she knew exactly and had been told not to say. Cecily had not asked again. She had, however, found a way in through the adjoining linen closet 6 weeks later, a connecting door behind a shelf that Victor had apparently not known existed because he had not locked it. She went there sometimes, in the early morning before the house was fully awake, and she sat in her father's chair and looked at the eastern light and did not think about anything in particular. She just sat. She found it necessary, in a way she could not have articulated, to exist in a space where she had not yet been replaced. It was in this room, on the morning after the ledger discovery, that she allowed herself to think clearly about the Duke of Ashford. She had known about the altered entry long before she had told him. She had known, in fact, about a great many things, because knowledge in her position was the only form of power available to her, and she had collected it the way a person stranded in a desert collects water, carefully, secretly, never wasting a drop. She knew that Victor had been drawing from the estate trust account since 3 months after her father's death. Small amounts at first, the kind that could be attributed to household expenses, to maintenance, to the ordinary costs of running an estate, then larger ones. She had found the discrepancies in the household ledgers because she had grown up watching her father review those same ledgers on Sunday evenings, and she knew what the numbers were supposed to look like. She knew that the eastern parcel boundary alteration was not an isolated act. There were at least two other survey documents that had been quietly adjusted. She had not been able to examine them directly, but she had seen enough of the correspondence that passed through the house to understand the shape of what Victor was building. He was not simply stealing from her. He was restructuring the estate itself, piece by piece, so that by the time she came of age to claim it, or by the time she married and a husband came to review the accounts, there would be nothing left to claim. Just a set of documents showing that this was always how the estate had been, that there had never been more, that the numbers had always looked like this. It was elegant, in a terrible way. She had given him that much in the private part of her mind where she kept thoughts she told no one. What she had also known, what had kept her awake more nights than she could count, was that none of it mattered if she had no one to tell it to. She had no money of her own. Victor had made certain of that, redirecting the small quarterly allowance stipulated in her father's will into household accounts he controlled, with the explanation that she was being asterisk provided for and had no need of independent funds. She had no close family. Her father's sister had died the previous year, and his brother was in India and might as well have been on the moon. She had friends from her girlhood, but they were married now, embedded in their own households, and she had no way to reach them that Victor could not monitor. She had considered once going directly to a solicitor. She had even walked to the edge of the village with that intention, on a Tuesday afternoon when Victor was in town and Mrs. Greer had been occupied with a delivery. She had stood outside the solicitor's office for 11 minutes. Then she had thought about what Victor had said 2 months earlier at dinner, when she had gently questioned an account entry. He had set down his fork. He had looked at her with the particular expression she had come to recognize, not angry, not loud, just carefully certain of himself. "You know," he had said, "our mother was also prone to seeing irregularities where none existed, patterns that weren't there, numbers that didn't add up the way she expected." A pause. It worried Father greatly, toward the end. Cecily had looked at him. "She was ill, of course," Victor had continued, cutting his meat. "It became quite serious. One doesn't like to think about it." He had gone back to his dinner. He had not looked at her again. She had stood outside the solicitor's office for 11 minutes, and then she had walked back to Whitmore House. Her mother had not been ill. This was the thing that Victor understood and used, and that Cecily carried like a stone in her chest every single day. Her mother had been inconvenient. She had been a woman with opinions about financial matters in a time when that was considered a symptom rather than a skill. And she had been quietly, efficiently, and completely legally removed from any position to act on those opinions, because her husband, Cecily's stepfather, Victor's father, had signed the papers, and two doctors had agreed, and that had been that. Cecily had been 11 years old. She remembered her mother's last morning at Whitmore House in the way one remembers things witnessed too young to fully understand, in fragments, in images, in the specific quality of a sound. The way her mother had looked at her from the carriage window, not frightened, past frightened, something quieter and worse than frightened. She had not seen her after that. Her mother had died in the institution 4 years later. The cause listed was a fever, which may have been true and may not have been. Victor had been 19 when it happened. He had watched and learned. And now he was applying the lesson. The morning after she had shown Edmund the ledger entry, she sat in her father's chair in the locked study, and she thought about what she had done. She had not meant to tell him. She had meant to stay invisible to complete the task, to give nothing away. But he had held the ledger up to the light, asterisk show me, he had said, as though it were simply the next logical step, and she had held it up, and he had stood beside her and looked, and she had been acutely aware that this was the closest she had stood to anyone in a very long time, and something in her had simply slipped. "How long have you known that was there?" 18 months. She had told him the truth. She didn't entirely know why. "Who are you?" And then Victor had appeared in the doorway, and she had remembered, all at once and with complete clarity, exactly where she was and what the stakes were. She had walked out of that library and down the corridor to the servants' stairs, and she had kept her breathing even and her steps measured, and she had not let herself think until she was somewhere private enough to think safely. She was thinking now. Edmund Ashford was not what she had expected. She had expected someone like Victor, the particular brand of aristocratic authority that expressed itself through indifference, that treated the people around it as furniture, useful or inconvenient but never quite real. She had prepared for that. She knew how to be invisible to that kind of person. But he looked at things directly. He asked questions and actually waited for the answers. He had said, "What would you recommend?" and then listened when she spoke as though what she said had weight. She was not accustomed to being listened to. It was more disorienting than she would have expected. She could not decide if he was an opportunity or a danger. She could not decide, and the inability to decide frightened her more than Victor's threats, because she was accustomed to Victor's threats. She had categorized them, measured them, built her life around navigating them. The Duke was something she had not built a category for. She had almost returned to the locked study the following evening when Mrs. Greer found her in the corridor. "Mr. Whitmore wants you," the housekeeper said quietly, not meeting her eyes. "His study, now." Victor's study was on the ground floor next to the formal dining room. It smelled of tobacco and something else, something underneath the tobacco, the faint sourness of anxiety disguised as authority. He was standing when she came in, which meant it was bad. He always stood when it was bad. "The Duke," he said without preamble, "what did you discuss?" "Translation work," she said, "as Mrs. Greer instructed." "And this morning, in the library?" "He asked me to cross-reference the inventory records against the estate ledgers." Victor's eyes moved over her face with the precision of a man looking for cracks. "And?" "It was routine work," she said. "I found nothing of interest." The lie came out cleanly. It always did now. She had practiced it in the way one practices any survival skill, not with pride, but with grim necessity. Victor was quiet for a long moment. "He's staying another week," he said finally. "I know. I want you available when he requests it. A pause. It's better to have you where I can see what you're saying than to have you elsewhere." She understood him perfectly. She was not being given access to Edmund. She was being kept close so Victor could manage what she revealed. "Of course," she said. She turned to leave. "Cecily." She stopped. He rarely used her name. When he did, it meant something specific. "You're sensible," he said behind her. "You always have been. You understand how these things work. How quickly a woman's instability can become apparent to people. How little it takes, sometimes, for the right people to become concerned." She did not turn around. "I understand," she said. "Good." She walked out of the study and down the corridor and through the door to the back passage. And she kept her breathing perfectly even until she was entirely alone. Then she stood very still in the dark of the back passage, and she allowed herself exactly 60 seconds of something that was not quite despair and not quite fury, but lived precisely in the territory between them. Then she straightened her spine. She thought about Edmund Ashford, standing beside her at the library window, looking at the ghost of an altered number in old ink. "Show me," he had said. She thought about the question he had asked before Victor had appeared in the doorway. "Who are you?" She had not answered. She had not decided yet whether she was going to. Edmund Ashford had a system. It had developed over years of managing an estate the size of a small county, navigating parliamentary politics, overseeing investment interests across three countries, and dealing with the particular brand of human dishonesty that congregates wherever significant money changes hands. The system was simple. He wrote everything down. He trusted nothing he could not verify, and he never asked a question he was not already most of the way to answering. He applied this system now. On Thursday evening, after the house had gone quiet, and Victor had retired to whatever he did in his private hours, drinking, Edmund suspected, based on the quality of his morning temper. Edmund sat at the writing desk in the guest bedroom and composed two letters. The first was to his London solicitor, a man named Cartwright who had served the Ashford estate for 11 years and who possessed the rare combination of complete discretion and genuine competence. Edmund outlined what he had found in the estate ledgers, the altered boundary notation, the acreage discrepancy, the particular quality of the ink used in the correction that suggested it had been made significantly after the surrounding entries. He asked Cartwright to pull whatever public records existed on the Whitmore estate title history going back 30 years. He asked him to do it quietly. The second letter was shorter. It was addressed to a man named Fellows, who was not a solicitor and not in any official capacity connected to Edmund's affairs, at least not on paper. Fellows had spent 12 years as a clerk in the Court of Chancery before a difference of opinion with a superior had ended that career and redirected his considerable skills toward private inquiry. Edmund had used him twice before. Both times, the information returned had been precise, thorough, and delivered without commentary or judgment, which Edmund valued above almost any other professional quality. He asked fellows to find whatever could be found, through public record and careful inquiry, about the Whitmore family, specifically the late Lord Whitmore's first marriage, specifically any children of that marriage, specifically the legal arrangements governing any inheritance or trust that might have been established for such children. He sealed both letters. He addressed them in his own hand. He did not give them to the Whitmore House footman for posting. He put them in his coat pocket and walked to the village himself the following morning, before breakfast, in the light drizzle of a November dawn, and posted them at the village post office directly. He was back at Whitmore House before the breakfast dishes were laid. Cecily noticed he had been out. She noticed because she was awake before the house most mornings, habit, necessity, and the particular restlessness of someone whose mind did not slow down easily, and because she had developed over 2 years an acute sensitivity to the movements of Whitmore House. She knew the sound of every door. She knew which floorboards announced themselves and which did not. She knew, without needing to check, whether Victor was in the house or out of it, whether Mrs. Greer was in the kitchen or the linen room, whether the night footman had fallen asleep at his post, as he invariably did after midnight. She knew the sound of the front door at 6:43 in the morning, and she knew that only one person in the house had both the authority to use it freely and the inclination to be awake at that hour. She filed it away without drawing conclusions. She was becoming very good at filing things away without drawing conclusions. Conclusions required commitment, and commitment, in her current situation, was a form of vulnerability she could not afford. The Italian correspondence had been dispatched. She had written Edmund's reply to the Florentine associate 2 days prior, and it had gone to the village by the regular post. But on Friday morning, Mrs. Greer appeared again at the door of the room Cecily had been given on the upper floor, a small room, adequately furnished, with a window that looked onto the stable yard, and said that His Grace had another task if she was available. "I'm available," Cecily said, because she was always available. That was the arrangement. The task, it turned out, was not translation. She found Edmund in the library again, standing at the window with his hands behind his back, looking out at the gray November gardens with the focused inattention of a man thinking about something other than what he was looking at. He turned when she came in. "Miss," he stopped, "Cecily." She waited. "I want to ask you something directly," he said. "And I want you to consider before you answer that I am not Victor Whitmore, and that what you say in this room will not leave it through me." The air in the room changed quality. She felt it, the particular atmospheric shift of a moment that is going to matter. She said nothing, which was not the same as agreement but was not disagreement either. He seemed to accept this. He moved to the writing desk and sat, not behind it but beside it, which she noticed, the deliberate removal of the desk as a barrier between them. "The ledger entry," he said, "the altered boundary, you said you noticed it 18 months ago."
"Yes."
"And you said nothing, not to Victor, not to anyone, I assume."
"No." "Why?"
She looked at him for a long moment. He looked back with that quality of attention she had not yet found a category for, not aggressive, not impatient, simply entirely present in the way that very few people ever were. "Because," she said carefully, asterisk, "knowledge without the means to act on it is not an asset. It's a liability."
A pause.
"That," Edmund said, "is an extremely precise answer." "You asked a precise question." Something moved in his expression, not quite a smile, but in the vicinity of one. "I did." He leaned back slightly. "I want to ask you another one."
She waited.
"Your surname," he said. "You gave me only a first name. I have not pressed it, but I am pressing it now." The room was very quiet. Somewhere outside, the stable yard sounds drifted faintly through the window. A horse, a voice, the ordinary sounds of a morning that did not know it was significant. She thought about Victor in his study, how quickly a woman's instability can become apparent. She thought about her mother in the carriage window, past frightened. She thought about 60 seconds in the dark of the back passage and what came after them. She thought about a man who posted his own letters before breakfast in a November drizzle. "Whitmore," she said. "My name is Cecily Whitmore. My father was the late Lord Whitmore. Victor is my stepbrother, and I have been living in this house for 2 years," as she glanced down at the gray dress, then back up, "whatever it has suited him to tell people I am." Edmund did not look surprised. He looked, she realized, like a man who has just had a thing confirmed that he already knew. "Your father's first marriage," he said. "Your mother was Charlotte Ashby before she married." It was not a question. Cecily went very still. "You knew?" "I suspected." He reached into the inside pocket of his coat and produced a small, folded piece of paper, not a letter, but a clipping, the kind that came from estate records or court documents. "Your father and mine had a land dispute in 1804. There was correspondence. I have a good memory for names." He set the paper on the desk between them without unfolding it. "I recognized you from your father's description in that correspondence. He mentioned a daughter." He was asterisk a brief pause, rather proud of her. The words landed somewhere Cecily had not expected them to land. She looked at the folded paper on the desk. She did not touch it. "How long?" she said. Her voice was steady. She was very careful about keeping it steady. "How long have you known who I was?" "Since the ball," Edmund said, "when you held the tray." "The ball, the first night. The gray dress and the tea tray and the 1 second she had looked up." "You've known since the first night," she said, "and you said nothing." "You said nothing," he replied quietly. "I was following your lead." She stared at him. "You were," she stopped. Something was happening in her chest that she did not entirely have control over, not tears. She was long past easy tears, but something that lived in the same region. "You were waiting for me to trust you enough to speak." "Yes," he said simply. The room held the silence for a long moment. Then Cecily sat down, not because he had invited her to, but because her legs had made a unilateral decision, in the chair across from him, and she folded her hands in her lap, and she looked at Edmund Ashford across the writing desk in the gray November light. "What are you going to do?" she asked. "That," he said, "depends considerably on what you want." No one had asked her that in 2 years. She was not, she discovered, entirely prepared for it. She was still in the library when the clock on the mantel struck 11. They had talked for nearly 2 hours, not in the way Cecily had conversations with Victor, which were exercises in concealment and survival, but in the way she had almost forgotten conversations could be. She had told him about the trust accounts, about the redirected allowance, about the survey documents she suspected had been altered. She had not told him about her mother. She was not ready for that yet. He had listened. He had asked questions, precise ones, the kind that told her he was building something in his mind, assembling pieces into a structure, the way a very good solicitor does, or a very thorough man. He had not expressed outrage, which she found, oddly, more reassuring than outrage would have been. Outrage was noise. What he was doing was quieter and more deliberate and considerably more useful. When she rose to leave, he stood as well, and she registered, in some part of her mind that was still capable of registering ordinary things, that he stood because she stood, which was not what men of his position did for women in gray dresses carrying tea trays. "Cecily." She turned at the door. "Be careful," he said, not dramatically, not as warning theater, just as a fact he wanted her to have. "Not because I think you aren't already being careful,
But because I am now involved and Victor will feel that, and men who feel cornered, he left it there. I know what cornered men do, she said. I know you do, he said. That's why I'm telling you. She nodded once, she left. She did not know, as she walked down the corridor toward the servants' stair, that Edmund's letter to Fellows had not reached the village post office. She did not know that the footman who handled the morning post, a young man named Dawes who had been in Victor's particular employ for 8 months longer than he had been in the household employ, had steamed open the letter at Victor's instruction the previous week, when Edmund's extended stay had first made Victor nervous. She did not know that Dawes had read the letter, that he had resealed it with reasonable competence, that he had posted it, and that he had also, that same morning, placed a note on Victor's breakfast tray. She did not know any of this. She walked up the servant's stair in the gray dress, and she felt, for the first time in 2 years, something that she was careful not to name yet, because naming it would make it real, and real things could be taken. But it was there. Something that felt cautiously, like the possibility of not being alone. The note on Victor's breakfast tray contained 11 words. He is asking about the first marriage, the daughter, the trust. Victor read it twice. Then he folded it into quarters and put it in his waistcoat pocket and finished his breakfast with the mechanical efficiency of a man who has decided that panic is a luxury he cannot afford this morning. He drank his coffee. He ate his toast. He looked out the window at the November gardens and thought very carefully. By the time he set down his cup, he had a plan. This was Victor's particular talent, not intelligence exactly, not the deep structural intelligence that Cecily had inherited from their father, but a narrower, more reactive cleverness. The cleverness of a man who has spent his life identifying threats and neutralizing them before they could fully form. He had learned it young, watching his own father manage inconvenient people, and he had refined it over years of practice until it was less a skill than an instinct. The threat here was not, he understood, the Duke's inquiry. Inquiries could be managed. Documents could be explained. Solicitors could be stalled, questioned, worn down by counter-documentation and procedural delay. Victor had been doing this with the land dispute for 2 years already and had become reasonably expert at it. The threat was Cecily. Cecily, who had apparently been speaking to the Duke. Cecily, who had been placed in the library at the Duke's request and had remained there, according to Mrs. Greer's careful accounting, for nearly 2 hours on a Friday morning. Cecily, who knew, he had always known that she knew, had always been aware of it like a low-grade fever, something managed but never resolved everything. The question was not what she had told him. Dawes could not report on that. The question was how much more she might tell him, now that someone was listening. Victor pushed back from the breakfast table and went to find her. He did not find her immediately, which irritated him in the specific way that small, logistical failures irritated men who needed to feel in control of their environments. She was not in her room, not in the kitchen, where Mrs. Greer said she had not been since morning, not in the back garden where she sometimes walked in the early afternoon. He found her, finally, in the corridor outside the linen room on the second floor, carrying a stack of folded table linens that someone had apparently asked her to redistribute. She was doing it with the unhurried competence she brought to everything, as though the task were entirely ordinary and she had nowhere else to be and nothing else on her mind. He had always found this quality of hers profoundly unsettling. He could not read her the way he could read other people. Most people leaked anxiety in the set of their shoulders, guilt in the quality of their eye contact, hope in the way they tilted toward things they wanted. Cecily contained herself so thoroughly that reading her was like trying to read a sealed letter. He had spent 2 years trying to open that letter. "A word," he said. She stopped. She looked at him over the stack of linens with an expression of polite attention that told him absolutely nothing. "Of course," she said. He did not want to have this conversation in the corridor. He opened the door to the small sitting room that adjoined the linen room, a rarely used space, furnished with the leftover pieces of three different decorating schemes, smelling of dust and dried lavender, and gestured her inside. She went, she set the linens on a chair, she stood and waited. Victor closed the door. He had prepared, on the walk from the breakfast room, a version of this conversation that was measured and reasonable, that framed his concerns as legitimate household management issues, that reminded her of her position without explicit threat, that relied on implication rather than statement. He had given this kind of speech before. It was usually effective. But standing in the small sitting room looking at Cecily's composed, unreadable face, the measured version evaporated. He was tired. He had been managing this situation for 2 years, and he was tired of managing it, and the Duke's presence in his house and the Duke's letters to London and the Duke's two-hour conversations with the woman standing in front of him had compressed something in Victor's chest that he needed to release. "Whatever you have told him," he said, "you will not tell him again." A pause. "I have assisted with translation work," Cecily said, "and some clerical tasks, as you instructed." "Don't." The word came out harder than he intended. "Don't do that with me, Cecily. Not right now. I know you've been talking to him. I know what you know. And I am telling you clearly and finally that if you have said anything, if you say anything about the estate accounts, about the survey documents, about anything that is none of your concern." "The trust accounts are my concern," she said, "by law." The room went very quiet. Victor looked at her. She looked back. It was the first time in 2 years she had said it directly, not implied it, not circled it, but said it outright, the way one states an uncontested fact. Something shifted in his face. She watched it shift, the measured version of himself that he had walked in with, sliding away, and something older and less controlled replacing it. "By law," he repeated. "Yes." "You want to talk about law?" He moved to the window, putting his back to her for a moment, which she recognized as a technique, giving himself time, taking the space, making himself feel larger in the room. Then he turned back. "Let me tell you something about law, Cecily. Law requires witnesses. Law requires documentation. Law requires a woman who is considered by the relevant parties to be in full possession of her faculties and her judgment." A pause. "Law is very difficult to access for a woman who is not." She held his gaze. "I am in full possession of my faculties," she said. "Of course you are," Victor said. "Right now you are. In this room today you are perfectly composed and entirely rational." He said it the way one might say it about a fire that was currently contained. "But these things can change. They can change very quickly. A woman under strain, a woman who has suffered loss, who lives in isolation, who has developed fixations about financial matters she doesn't fully understand," he let it trail. "People notice these things. Doctors notice them. And once a doctor has noticed, once the paperwork is in motion..." "Stop." The word came out before she chose it. It was the first time in 2 years she had interrupted him. Victor stopped. She was looking at him with an expression that had finally, after 2 years, cracked its containment, not into fear, which was what he had expected and perhaps wanted, but into something he had not anticipated. "You will not do to me what your father did to my mother," she said. Her voice was completely level. "You will not. Because I am not my mother, I did not make my mother's mistake, which was trusting that decency would protect her. I have not trusted that. I have been preparing for this conversation for 18 months, Victor, and I have documentation of my own in a location you cannot access that establishes a clear and detailed record of every discrepancy I have found in the estate accounts." It was a lie. There was no documentation. She had nothing in a location he could not access. She had nothing at all, no allies, no resources, no independent record of anything. She had her memory, which was excellent, and her knowledge, which was thorough, and the ghost of an altered number in an estate ledger that she had shown to a duke who might or might not be in a position to help her. But Victor did not know that. And she had learned, watching him for 2 years, that Victor's particular cleverness had one significant weakness. It was reactive. It required a known threat to respond to. Uncertainty destabilized him in ways that direct opposition did not, because direct opposition he could fight and uncertainty he could not. She watched the uncertainty move across his face now. "You're lying," he said. "Perhaps," she said. "Are you certain enough of that to act on it?" A long silence. Victor's jaw tightened. Then slowly it released. He looked at her for a moment with an expression she could not entirely read, and then she could read it, and it was worse than anger. It was the expression of a man recalculating. "Get out," he said quietly. She picked up the linens from the chair. She walked to the door, opened it, and paused. "Victor," she said, without turning around, "if anything happens to me, if I am removed from this house, or committed, or simply disappear, there is someone who will ask questions, someone who will not be easily satisfied with the answers." She did not name him. She did not need to. She walked out. She made it to the end of the corridor before her hands started shaking. She stood at the top of the servant's stair and gripped the banister and breathed slowly, deliberately, the way she had learned to breathe when everything in her wanted to do something else entirely. The linens were still in her arms. She became aware of this in a distant way, as though her body was continuing its duties while the rest of her stood slightly apart. The lie had worked. For now, she had bought herself what? A day. Perhaps two. Victor would recalculate and he would probe, and eventually he would decide whether she was bluffing. And when he decided she was bluffing, he would act, and she did not know exactly what that action would look like, but she knew it would be swift, and it would be legal, and it would be entirely devastating. She needed to move faster than he did. She needed to do the thing she had been standing at the edge of for 2 days. The thing she had been turning over and measuring and weighing against every risk she could enumerate. The thing that required her to trust someone she had known for less than a week with the only leverage she had left. She needed to tell Edmund everything. She wrote the letter that evening. Not to Edmund, she could not trust the house's post, and she could not walk to the village unseen at this hour. She wrote it to herself. The way she had always processed things, in the precise and private shorthand she had developed at her father's desk as a child, watching him review his correspondence and explaining to her, patiently, that a well-made argument had a structure, and that the structure mattered as much as the content. She laid out the argument clearly, what she knew, what she could prove and what she could not, what Victor had said today, what he was likely to do next, what she needed from Edmund, and what she was willing, no, what she was able to offer in return, which was the complete account of everything she had documented in her memory over 18 months, organized and precise and detailed enough that a competent solicitor could work with it. She read it back to herself. It was a good argument, thorough, logical, complete. Then she burned it in the small fireplace in her room, because she could not risk it being found. But she had it now, organized, clear, sequenced, in the place Victor could never reach. She lay down on the narrow bed in the room with the window that looked onto the stable yard, and she stared at the ceiling, and she thought about Edmund's face when he had said, "Asterisk, I was following your lead." She thought about her mother in the carriage window, past frightened, something quieter and worse than frightened. She thought about what it would mean to let someone in, the specific, irreversible vulnerability of it, the thing that once done could not be undone. Then she thought about the alternative. In the morning, she decided. She would find him in the morning before Victor had a chance to act, before the house was fully awake and watching. She would tell him everything. She closed her eyes. For the first time in a very long time, she had a plan that was not entirely defensive. It felt terrifyingly like hope. She did not find him in the morning. She was up before 6, dressed before the housemaids had begun their rounds, down the back stair and through the corridor toward the library before the breakfast things had been laid. She moved quickly and quietly, the way she had learned to move through this house, without announcing herself, without disturbing the air. The library was empty. She checked the small anteroom, the morning room, the corridor that led to the east wing where the guest rooms were situated. Nothing. The house had the particular stillness of early morning, that suspended quality before the day commits to itself, and somewhere in it Edmund Ashford was not where she needed him to be. She found out later, from the junior footman who had been at his post near the front door since 5, that the Duke had left the house at 6:30 on horseback. She did not know where he had gone. She went back upstairs and she sat on the edge of her narrow bed, and she looked at the window that faced the stable yard, and she told herself that one morning's delay was not a disaster. That Victor needed time to recalculate, that she had bought that time with a lie, and the lie was still holding. She told herself these things with reasonable conviction until she heard at 9:30, the sound of Victor's voice in the downstairs hall, not his usual controlled morning voice, but something faster and higher, the voice he used when something had gone wrong. And then she heard, beneath it, a second voice, low and even and entirely unhurried. She was at the top of the stairs before she had consciously decided to move. Edmund had not, it turned out, gone riding. He had ridden to the neighboring estate, Ashworth Park, seat of Lord Penville, the same Lord Penville that Victor had introduced him to at the ball, and he had arrived unannounced at 7 in the morning, which was either extremely rude or the behavior of a man who needed information before the day began, and had decided that social convention was a secondary concern. Lord Penville, who had known Edmund Ashford for 20 years, and had never once found social convention to be the man's primary concern, had let him in without comment and fed him breakfast. What they discussed over that breakfast, Cecily would learn later, in fragments over time, in the way that the important conversations always reach you, not all at once, but in pieces, assembled gradually into a whole. What she knew, standing at the top of the stairs at 9:30, was only what she could hear. Victor's voice, tight and climbing. "Entirely inappropriate, Your Grace, I must say. I don't know what you think gives you the right to go making inquiries about my household without." Edmund's voice, level and unhurried, with the quality of a man who has prepared for this conversation and is not finding it surprising. "The right is a matter of public record, Whitmore. The land trust documentation was filed with the Court of Chancery in 1807. It is not a private matter. The trust is not your concern. The trust involves property that borders my own estate and documents that your solicitor has repeatedly declined to produce in their original form. That makes it my concern." A pause, Victor recalibrating. "Whatever you think you found." "I haven't found anything," Edmund said. "Your solicitor has declined to produce documentation. That is not the same as finding something. It is, however, the kind of pattern that interests a court of law." Cecily moved down 3 steps, quietly. "This is harassment," Victor said. The word came out thinner than he intended. She could hear it. "You come into my home, you use my staff, you go making inquiries with my neighbors." "Lord Penville was your father's solicitor before he was your neighbor," Edmund said. "Did you know that? Before he inherited his title, he spent 12 years at the bar. He remembers the original trust documentation rather clearly. He drew it up." Silence. It was the specific silence of a man who has just realized that the ground he thought he was standing on has been gone for some time. Cecily descended 2 more steps. She could see them now, through the gap in the banister, Victor in the center of the entrance hall, his shoulders in the position she recognized as barely controlled, and Edmund standing near the door to the morning room with his hands behind his back, entirely still, the stillness of a man who has nowhere urgent to be because everything is already in motion. "Lord Penville," Victor said carefully, "is an old man with an old man's memory." "He is 61," Edmund said. "His memory is excellent. He also retained copies of the original trust documents, as was his professional practice at the time. Copies which, unlike the versions your solicitor has been producing, have not been altered." The word asterisk altered dropped into the hall like a stone into still water. Victor said nothing. "The eastern parcel boundary," Edmund continued in exactly the same tone. "The acreage notation in the 1809 survey, the trust account figures for the years 1817 and 1818. A brief pause. Shall I continue?" "You have no." "I have Lord Penville's copies," Edmund said. "I have my own solicitor's preliminary findings, which arrived this morning by express post from London. And I have, asterisk another pause, the briefest one, a rather comprehensive account of the estate's financial history from someone with direct and detailed knowledge of its discrepancies." Victor went very still. "What someone?" he said. And Edmund looked up. Not at Victor. At the staircase. Cecily had not meant to be seen. She had come down far enough to hear and no further. That had been the intention, the careful, controlled intention of a woman who had survived 2 years, by knowing exactly how much space she occupied, and ensuring it was never more than necessary. But she had come down one step too many, and Edmund had looked up, and now Victor was turning, and there was nothing to do but continue. She walked down the remaining stairs. She was wearing the gray dress. She was always wearing the gray dress. Her hair was pinned simply, nothing elaborately done, because she had dressed that morning for efficiency rather than occasion. She was aware, descending those stairs into the entrance hall of her father's house with both men watching her, that she looked exactly like what Victor had told everyone she was. She also, at this particular moment, did not care. She reached the bottom of the stairs, and she stopped, and she looked at Victor. His face had gone through several things in the past 10 seconds. She watched the last of them settle, not the recalculation she was accustomed to, not the measuring assessment, but something rawer. Something that looked, for the first time in 2 years, like genuine fear. "Cecily," he said. Her name in his mouth had the sound of a last move on a board game running out of options. She said nothing. Edmund spoke. "Miss Whitmore," he said. The name, her full name, her real name, spoken in the entrance hall of her father's house in front of the man who had spent 2 years erasing it. "Miss Whitmore." She turned to Edmund. "Your Grace," she said. "I was just explaining to your stepbrother," Edmund said, with the same level precision he brought to everything, "that Lord Penville has agreed to make his copies of the original trust documentation available to my solicitor. Cartwright is expected to arrive from London tomorrow morning." "Tomorrow," Victor said. Something in his voice had changed. The climbing quality was gone, replaced by something flatter. "You've arranged this already." "I arranged it this morning," Edmund said, "over breakfast." "You had no right." "The trust names a beneficiary," Edmund said. "That beneficiary has rights that supersede yours in every particular that matters. What I have done is ensure that those rights have someone competent to represent them." He looked at Victor with the expression of a man closing a ledger. "What you have done, Whitmore, is a matter that Cartwright will outline in considerably more precise terms than I am choosing to use at present. The hall was very quiet. Victor looked at Cecily. She had spent 2 years learning to read his face, cataloging every variation of his expressions, every shift and flicker that signaled what was coming next. She read his face now, and she understood that he was not finished, that a cornered man is not a defeated man, that the recalculation she could see happening behind his eyes right now was the most dangerous version of him she had encountered yet, not the confident Victor, not the threatening Victor, but the desperate one. "This woman," Victor said, and the deliberateness of asterisk "this woman" rather than her name was its own kind of signal, "has been living under my roof for 2 years in a state of considerable instability. She has made accusations before against the staff, against household management decisions, accusations that were examined and found to be."
"Stop."
Edmund said it the way Cecily had said it to Victor the day before, not loudly, not with heat, but with a finality that occupied the entire room. Victor stopped. "I am going to tell you something," Edmund said, "and I want you to hear it clearly." He did not raise his voice. He did not need to. "I have spoken with Miss Whitmore on several occasions this week. I have found her to be precise, accurate, methodical, and in complete possession of every faculty relevant to the matters under discussion. I have also found her account of events in this household to be consistent with the documentary evidence my solicitor is reviewing." A pause. "If you intend to pursue the line of argument I believe you are approaching, I would strongly advise you to reconsider. The institutional remedy you are perhaps contemplating requires, among other things, the endorsement of a physician. I have several acquaintances in that profession. I suspect their assessment would differ from whatever you had in mind." The silence that followed was the longest one yet. Victor looked at Edmund, then at Cecily, then at some middle point between them where there was nothing but air and the collapse of 2 years of careful architecture. His shoulders dropped, slightly, just enough. It was not surrender, not yet, but it was the thing that comes before surrender, the moment when a man understands that the war has already been lost and is beginning to count the cost of continuing anyway. Cecily breathed. "I think," Edmund said, in a tone that left no room for interpretation, "that it would be appropriate for you to make yourself available to speak with my solicitor tomorrow morning, at 9 o'clock, in the library." He said it the way one says things that are not requests. "I also think that Miss Whitmore might benefit from being moved to rooms more appropriate to her position in this household, today." Victor said nothing. "Whitmore," Edmund said. "Yes," Victor said quietly, "fine." He walked past them both toward his study. He did not look at either of them. The study door closed behind him, not slammed, which was almost worse than slamming would have been. The entrance hall was very quiet. Cecily became aware, gradually, of several things in sequence. That she was standing in the hall of her father's house and Victor had just walked away from a direct confrontation for the first time in 2 years. That her hands, at her sides, were entirely still. That Edmund Ashford was looking at her with an expression that was not quite anything she had a name for. She found that she could not immediately speak. He did not appear to require her to. "Cartwright will be here tomorrow," he said after a moment. "He is thorough and he is good and he will need your account of everything you know, dates, figures, specific discrepancies. Can you do that?" "Yes," she said. She had it all. Every figure, every date, organized and sequenced in the place Victor had never been able to reach.
"Good."
A pause. "You went to Lord Penville," she said.
"This morning."
"You knew he had the original documents." "I suspected. His background made it likely." "You have been," she stopped, "assembled it. You have been building this for days." "Since the library," he said, "since the window." since she had held the ledger up to the light, since show me. She looked at him for a long moment. The gray dress, the stable yard window, 2 years of the gray dress and the stable yard window and careful, quiet, defensive survival, and this man, who had arrived for a land dispute and stayed for a week and ridden out at 6 in the morning to breakfast with a retired solicitor, quietly and systematically dismantling everything Victor had built. Why, she said, not ungratefully, genuinely. Edmund looked at her. Because it was wrong, he said simply, and because I was in a position to do something about it, a brief pause, and because he stopped. Something in his expression shifted slightly into territory that was less professional and more something else. Because you held that ledger up to the light and showed me when you had every reason not to, and I found that I could not simply leave it there. Cecily looked at him. The morning light came through the tall windows of the entrance hall the way it always had, since she was a child. The particular Whitmore House morning light that she had not let herself feel anything about in 2 years, because feeling things about it was too expensive. She felt it now, just briefly, she let herself. Thank you, she said. Edmund nodded once. Then, because he was Edmund Ashford, and he did not linger in moments that had already said everything they needed to say, he turned toward the morning room. Breakfast, he said. You should eat something. Cartwright arrives at 9 tomorrow, and it will be a long day. She almost smiled, almost. Yes, Your Grace, she said. He paused, turned back slightly. Edmund, he said, in private at least, I think we are past Your Grace. She looked at him. Edmund, she said. He nodded. He went into the morning room. Cecily stood in the entrance hall of her father's house for a moment longer. Then she followed. Cartwright arrived at 9:05. He was a small man, neat in the way that people who work with documents tend to be neat, precise at the edges, economical in his movements, carrying a leather case that had the worn, authoritative look of something that had been present at the resolution of a great many difficult situations. He shook Edmund's hand. He acknowledged Cecily with a careful courtesy that told her Edmund had prepared him, that she was not the housemaid, not the girl, not an afterthought, but the reason Cartwright was here at all. She had not slept much. She had lain in her narrow room with the stable yard window and gone through everything in her memory, every figure, every date, every discrepancy she had cataloged over 18 months, organizing it the way her father had taught her to organize an argument. Structure first, then evidence, then conclusion. She had gone through it 3 times until the sequence was so clean and so certain that she could have recited it in her sleep, which was fortunate because sleep had been largely unavailable. Victor had not appeared at breakfast. Mrs. Greer had informed Edmund, with the particular neutrality of a woman who had been waiting 2 years for something to shift, and was not yet certain it had, that Mr. Whitmore had taken a tray in his room. Edmund had received this information without expression, and had poured Cecily a cup of coffee, and pushed the toast rack toward her and said nothing, which she had found, in its quiet way, to be one of the more sustaining things anyone had done for her in recent memory. Now she sat in the library across from Cartwright, and she told him everything. It took 3 hours. Cartwright asked questions the way Edmund looked at things directly, completely, without unnecessary commentary. He wrote in a small, precise hand, filling pages with the unhurried efficiency of a man who understood that the quality of the record mattered more than the speed of its creation. He asked her to repeat certain figures. He asked her to clarify certain dates. He cross-referenced what she told him against Lord Penville's original documents, which he had collected on his way through the village, and 3 times he stopped and looked at her over the top of his spectacles, with an expression that said that matches exactly without saying it aloud. Edmund sat at the far end of the library for most of it, not close enough to direct or interrupt, but present. She was aware of him there in the way one is aware of a steady thing in a room that is otherwise uncertain. At 11:30, Cartwright set down his pen and looked at her. "Miss Whitmore," he said, "what you have given me this morning, together with Lord Penville's documentation and my own preliminary findings, constitutes a substantive case of trust fraud. The alterations to the survey documents, the redirected allowance, the unauthorized drawings from the principal accounts, these are not ambiguous. They are not matters of interpretation." He paused. "They are crimes." She had known this. She had known it for 18 months in the careful private accounting of her own mind. But hearing it said aloud by a London solicitor with a leather case in the library of her father's house was something different from knowing it. "What happens now?" she said. "That depends on how you wish to proceed," Cartwright said. "You have several options. The matter can be referred to the relevant authorities, in which case Victor Whitmore faces criminal prosecution. It can be handled through civil proceedings, which would restore the trust assets and establish damages but would not result in criminal charges unless you chose to pursue them separately." Or, he paused, "a private resolution can be negotiated, in which Whitmore surrenders all claim to the estate and trust assets, makes full financial accounting, and removes himself from the situation, in exchange for the matter remaining out of the courts." "Which would you recommend?" she said. Cartwright glanced, briefly, at Edmund at the far end of the room. "That is not my recommendation to make," he said carefully. "It is your decision." She looked at the table, at Lord Penville's original documents laid out in their careful order, at 18 months of memory, finally in the world outside her head, organized on paper, real. "I want the assets restored," she said. "I want full accounting. I want him gone from this house." A pause. "I do not want to spend the next 3 years in a courtroom." Cartwright nodded. "Then we negotiate." Victor came down at 2:00. He had dressed carefully, which she noticed, the deliberate assembly of a man trying to reconstruct authority from the outside in, because the inside had run out. He looked older than he had yesterday. Not dramatically, not in a way anyone who hadn't been watching him for 2 years would have caught, but she caught it. The particular aging that happens to people when the thing holding them up quietly gives way. He sat across from Cartwright. Edmund stood by the window. Cecily sat beside Cartwright. This was the thing Victor had not anticipated, she realized, watching his eyes move across the room and settle on her position, beside the solicitor, not behind him, not in the doorway, not at the periphery where she had existed for 2 years. He had anticipated the Duke. He had anticipated the solicitor. He had perhaps even anticipated Penville's documents. He had not anticipated Cecily at the table. The negotiation took 2 hours. She would not have called it pleasant. Pleasant was not the appropriate word for sitting across from a man who had spent 2 years systematically dismantling your life, while he listened to a solicitor enumerate the evidence of his own crimes in a flat professional voice. But it was, in its way, clarifying. All the things that had existed in her head, the numbers, the dates, the discrepancies existed now in a room, in a document, named and accounted for, and Victor could not make them disappear by looking at her a certain way or saying her mother's name. He tried once in the early part of it, a sideways suggestion that certain of the account figures might be subject to alternative interpretation, that there were legitimate expenses that explained. "The 1818 figures," Cartwright said, setting down a document in front of Victor without looking up, "correspond to a period during which you were in Bath for 6 weeks and the estate was in the management of the understeward. The understeward kept his own records. I have them." Victor did not suggest alternative interpretations after that. By 4:00, it was done, or the shape of it was done. A full accounting to be completed within 60 days. restoration of the trust principal with interest, transfer of the household management back to Cecily's authority effective immediately, Victor's removal from Whitmore House by the end of the month, a signed document acknowledging the terms, the preparation of which Cartwright would oversee personally. Victor signed without speaking. He looked at the document for a long moment after the pen was down. Then he looked at Cecily. She had prepared, in the part of herself that prepared for things, for many different versions of this moment. For anger, for more threats, for some final attempt at the kind of damage a person can do on their way out when they have nothing left to protect. She had prepared for all of it. What she had not prepared for was what actually happened. Victor looked at her, and he looked tired. Just tired. The particular exhaustion of a man who has spent years sustaining something unsustainable and has finally been permitted to stop. He said nothing. He got up from the table and he walked out of the library, and she listened to his footsteps cross the entrance hall and go up the stairs, and then the house was quiet. Cartwright stayed for dinner. Edmund had insisted. And Cartwright had accepted with the gracious practicality of a man who understood that the day's work deserved a proper meal before the drive back to the village inn. Mrs. Greer, who had apparently been informed of the afternoon's developments through whatever efficient channel Mrs. Greer used to know everything in this house, produced a dinner of a quality that had not appeared on the Whitmore table in some time. Cecily sat at the head of the table. She had not planned this. She had come into the dining room and found the place settings arranged with herself at the head and Edmund to her right, and for a moment she had simply stood there, looking at it, while something rearranged itself quietly in her chest. She sat down. The conversation at dinner was largely between Edmund and Cartwright a practical matters, follow-up steps, the timeline for the accounting. Cecily contributed where she had information to add, which was often, and Cartwright made small notes in the margin of his papers, and Edmund listened with the focused quality she had come to recognize as his form of attention. At one point, Cartwright said something that required her to clarify a specific figure from 1817, and she gave it without hesitation. The exact amount, the date, the account it had been drawn from, and Cartwright looked up at her over his spectacles again with that expression. "You kept all of this," he said, "in your memory." "There was nowhere else to keep it," she said. Cartwright was quiet for a moment. "Remarkable," he said, not as flattery, as a professional assessment. She did not know what to do with it, so she reached for her wine. Across the table, Edmund said nothing. But she was aware, without looking at him directly, of something in his expression that she filed away carefully in the place she was building, the place for things she was not yet ready to examine completely. Cartwright left at 8:30. The house settled into the particular quiet of a November evening, fire in the sitting room, the last of the daylight long gone, the sounds of the staff moving through their final duties before the household retired. Victor's door had not opened since 4:00. He was in there, behind it, and she found that she did not particularly want to think about him tonight. She was in the sitting room with a book she had not been reading when Edmund appeared in the doorway. "May I?" She set the book down. "Of course." He came in and sat in the chair across from hers, the same positioning as the library, the same removal of barriers, which she had come to understand was deliberate on his part. He did not sit behind things. They were quiet for a moment in the way that people are quiet when there is a great deal to say, and neither of them is certain where to start. "How are you?" he said. It was such a simple question. She had not been asked it, she realized, since her father died. Not genuinely, not the way he asked it, which was with the implication that the answer mattered and he had time to hear it. "I don't entirely know," she said honestly. "I have been oriented toward this day for a long time. I'm not certain I know yet what comes after it." That's reasonable, he said.
Is it?
You have been surviving, he said. Survival requires all of your attention. When it stops requiring all of your attention, there is often a gap before the next thing fills it.
She looked at him. You speak from experience.
A brief pause. My father died when I was 22 and left the estate in considerably worse condition than anyone had known. I spent 3 years doing nothing but managing the crisis. He looked at the fire. When it was resolved, I didn't know what to do with a Tuesday afternoon.
She almost smiled. What did you do?
Rode to London and made a series of investments that turned out to be reasonably sound. A pause. It was not a particularly imaginative response to freedom.
It was practical, she said.
It was what I knew how to do.
The fire settled. Outside, the wind had picked up, the particular November wind that came off the eastern fields and made the old house creak in ways she had known her whole life.
Edmund, she said.
He looked at her.
I owe you an apology, she said. Or, not an apology, an acknowledgement. She considered it. You extended something to me from the beginning of this that I was not in a position to fully receive. You were patient with that. I want you to know that I was aware of it.
You had reason to be careful, he said.
I had reason, she agreed. But there is a point at which careful becomes something else, something that is less about protection and more about habit. She paused. I burned a letter last week.
I know, he said.
She looked at him. How?
The smell, he said. In the corridor outside your room, paper and ink.
A pause. I didn't know what was in it, but I thought whatever it was, you would either rebuild it or you wouldn't. And if you did, you would find a way to reach me with it.
You were not wrong, she said.
No.
Quiet again. The fire, the wind.
What happens now, she said, for you? You came for a land dispute.
The land dispute, he said, has been rather overtaken by events.
Cartwright will need to return.
Several times, probably.
And you?
He looked at her steadily.
I find, he said, that I have become rather invested in how this particular situation resolves, and I am not in the habit of leaving things I am invested in before they are properly finished.
She held his gaze.
That is a very careful way to say something, she said.
I'm a careful man, he said.
I know, she said, I have noticed.
The corner of his mouth moved, just slightly, the vicinity of a smile.
Cecily, he said.
Edmund,
I would like, with your permission, to call on you. He said it with the formal phrasing, the correct phrasing, the phrasing that meant something specific, and they both knew it meant something specific. Properly, when this is settled, when you have had time for the gap to fill.
She was quiet for a moment.
Outside the wind, inside the fire, her father's house settling around her in the dark.
I think, she said carefully, that I would like that.
He nodded once, in the way that she had come to understand was his version of something much larger.
Good, he said.
And then, because he was Edmund, he picked up a document from the side table, some follow-up matter from Cartwright's stack, and began to read it, which was somehow exactly the right thing to do, the ordinary thing, the thing that said the extraordinary part of this evening is finished, and we are simply two people now in a room, and that is sufficient.
She picked up her book.
For the first time in 2 years, she read it.
1 year later, the dinner was at Ashford House.
Not a ball, Edmund did not give balls, which was one of the many things Cecily had discovered about him in the course of a year that had rearranged her understanding of what a life could look like. He gave dinners. Considered, well-appointed dinners with excellent food and interesting guests and conversation that went somewhere rather than merely circling itself, which was how most society conversation spent its evenings.
30 guests tonight. The dining room at Ashford House seated 40,
which meant it did not feel crowded, which was intentional. She had learned that Edmund thought about rooms the way he thought about everything, with attention to the thing that would make people most comfortable and least aware of being managed. She stood near the fireplace in the drawing room before dinner, in a gown the color of deep water, not gray, never gray again. She had been privately absolute about this. And she held a glass of champagne, and she listened to Lord Penville's wife describe a journey to Bath with the particular enthusiasm of a woman who had found her ideal audience. Lord Penville himself appeared at her elbow. "You look well," he said, with the directness of a man who had spent his career in law and saw no point in indirection at 61. "I am well," she said, and meant it, which still occasionally surprised her. "The estate," he said. "Cartwright tells me the restoration is complete." "As of last month, the accounting closed in September." He nodded, and Whitmore. "In Edinburgh," she said. "He has a position there, clerical." She said it without heat. She had spent some time over the past year deciding what to feel about Victor, and had arrived eventually at something that was not forgiveness exactly, but was the practical understanding that carrying him with her cost more than setting him down. "He is someone else's Tuesday afternoon problem now." Penville laughed, a genuine one, short and appreciative. "Your father would have said exactly that." She looked at him. "Did you know him well?" "Well enough," Penville said. "He was a good man. Exact, fair, rather better at numbers than at people." A pause. "Though not," he added, glancing across the room to where Edmund was accepting a glass of wine from a footman while listening to something a young MP was saying with the polite attention of a man who is not entirely convinced, entirely without precedent in this house. She followed his gaze. As though he felt it, Edmund looked up. Across the drawing room, across 30 guests and the particular warm light of Ashford House in November, his eyes found her with the directness that had not changed in a year that she suspected would not change. He did not smile. He rarely did in public in the way that other people smiled. But something in his expression shifted, the small private shift that she had learned to read, that said, "I see you. I know exactly where you are, and this is precisely where I want you to be." She held his gaze for a moment. Then Penville's wife reappeared at her elbow with a question about Bath, and she turned, and the evening continued. Dinner was announced at 8. Edmund let her in. Not because protocol required it. Protocol would have had him lead in the highest-ranking woman present, which was Lady Ashworth, who was a countess and therefore senior. But Edmund had, at some point in the preceding year, developed a relationship with protocol that was best described as selective. And tonight, he offered his arm to Cecily, and she took it and Lady Ashworth, who had been told the situation in broad strokes by a mutual acquaintance, and was broadly sympathetic to it, smiled into her champagne and said nothing. They sat at the head of the table together. She was introduced by Edmund to each new guest he greeted, not as asterisk my guest or asterisk Miss Whitmore. You may remember or any of the careful social formulations that left the important part unstated. He introduced her as asterisk Cecily Whitmore, of Whitmore House in Wiltshire, which was accurate and complete and said exactly what it needed to say about who she was and where she stood, without requiring further explanation. Several of the guests had been at the Whitmore Ball a year ago. She recognized three of them, the couple near the center of the table who had been standing near the fireplace when Victor had said our housemaid, quite reliable, the older woman at the far end who had watched the whole thing with the expression of someone filing it away. None of them said anything. One of them, the older woman, catching her eye across the table during the second course, gave a small, deliberate nod. The kind that acknowledged something without naming it. The kind that said, I know what I saw, and I know what I am seeing now, and I am glad they are different things. Cecily nodded back. After dinner in the drawing room over coffee, Edmund appeared at her side. "Penvel's wife," he said quietly, "has cornered the MP about the Bath Road conditions. He looks as though he is considering the window as an exit."
"He should consider the door," she said. "It is closer."
He stood beside her, both of them looking at the room with the particular comfortable parallel attention of two people who have learned each other's way of seeing things. "Are you tired?"
"No."
"Good." A pause. "Cartwright sends his regards, by the way. He is coming to London next week. He wants to discuss the eastern parcel."
"The survey."
"The original boundary. He believes there may be," Edmund paused. "Actually, tomorrow. We can discuss it tomorrow."
She looked at him. "You were going to talk about land surveys at your own dinner party."
"The thought occurred to me," he said without apology.
"Edmund."
"Cecily."
She shook her head, not in frustration, in the way one shakes one's head at something that is entirely consistent and entirely themselves and cannot be helped.
"Tomorrow," she said.
"Tomorrow," he agreed. He offered her a small plate of something from the table beside them, the sort of automatic consideration that had become, over a year, so habitual that she thought he was barely aware he did it anymore.
She took it.
They stood together in the drawing room of Ashford House, and the party moved around them, and she thought, not for the first time and with the same quiet steadiness every time, that she had spent 2 years learning to survive, and she was only now, gradually, learning to do the other thing. The thing that came after surviving. She was not certain yet what to call it. She had not needed to name it because it was simply present, in the way that things are present when they are real, not announced, not performed, just there in the room, in the ordinary moments, in a plate of something passed without thinking, and a man who knew exactly where she was, and a drawing room full of people who called her by her name.
Her name.
Cecily Whitmore of Whitmore House. She had not been introduced as the housemaid tonight. She did not correct anyone.
She didn't need to.
Thank you for listening to the story all the way to the end. Please tell us which city you're watching from and what the story made you feel. Don't forget to subscribe so you won't miss new stories.